Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turtletaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. I am coming to you today from the office of Garrett Reisman. Garrett's been a keynote presenter at many of our conferences. He's a former astronaut who made two trips to space, spending over 100 days there. Formerly, he was the director of space operations at SpaceX and currently serves as a special advisor there. And he's also a professor of engineering at USC. Garrett, thanks for having me to your office.
Thanks for coming here.
So first, I think it's worth noting that as exciting as spaceflight is...
By the way, it was 107 days.
107 days. Good. Okay. Yeah.
Not that I'm counting.
Not that you're counting and not that I have zero. So first, I think it's worth noting that as exciting as spaceflight is, it's still a very risky thing. Can you put the risk in perspective?
Well, yes. I mean, so far, we have not found a way to travel regularly into space with a lot of... very safely, to be frank about it. It is really risky. It's a very dangerous thing to do. A lot of it's because of the physics involved and the energy involved. A lot of it's because of just that we haven't been doing it for that long compared to flying in airplanes or driving automobiles. But it is super risky. And to put it in perspective, my mom is scared of flying, just like on commercial airplanes. And when you fly in a commercial airplane, it's incredibly safe. The statistics show that your chance of dying during a commercial flight in the U.S., is one in six million. And in fact, the Southwest accident that happened recently was the first time they had a fatality on any Southwest flight. And you just imagine how many Southwest flights there are every day. And that was the first fatality on a U.S. airliner in 9 years. And think about how many millions of people fly every year. So when you look at the numbers, flying on airplanes is very, very safe. My mom still doesn't believe it, but trust me, it's true. Flying to space, however, is not so. We had, for example, in the space shuttle program, we had 135 missions. We lost two of them. So your odds of dying on the space shuttle, using that metric, are 1 in 67. 1 in 67 compared to 1 in 6 million. So that gives you an idea of the many orders of magnitude increase in risk from commercial aviation to flying in space. 1 in 67 is also coincidentally about the same number, the same probability, as an infantryman had on D-Day when the Allies stormed the beaches at Normandy in World War II. The chances, if you were an infantryman, that you were going to make it off of that beach or not make it off that beach were about 1 in 67. So having flown in space twice is like storming the beaches at Normandy twice. That's how dangerous it was. Now... don't get me wrong, I love doing it. And I was super excited about it. And I wasn't even that scared. I mean, what was going through my mind right when we launched was not, oh my goodness, this is really dangerous. It was, oh my goodness, please don't let me mess this up. I was more worried about making a mistake and not doing a good job than it was about anything ill toward happening to me. But it is, analytically anyway, it is very dangerous. We're trying to do better as we go forward into the future, but at least up till now, it's not been all that safe.
Yeah, I can imagine the pressure. And by your own admission, you were a passenger in those launches and still afraid of doing something wrong.
Yes. Well, in the first launch, I was a total passenger. I was downstairs. I didn't even have a window. And all I do is high-five my spacewalk partner all the way up to orbit. But on my second flight, I was on the flight deck. And I was a little, even without a job during ascent, you have jobs to do immediately after. And the whole next, this whole sequence, this whole mission that you're just starting, there's a million things you're worried about messing up. And I trust me, I was perfectly capable of messing it up entirely.
Well, thankfully for you and all of us, you didn't. So let's go back to the two space shuttle tragedies you talked about, Challenger and Columbia. What were some of the lessons that were learned from them that you think would be relevant for this audience?
There's a bunch of lessons from the accidents or the tragedies we had, and not only Challenger and Columbia, but also Apollo 1. In the Apollo program, we lost three crew members in a fire on the launch pad without even lighting the engines of the vehicle. The capsule caught fire, and we lost Grissom, White, and Chafee. So really, if you look at those three seminal tragedies in the American space program, you find that there are a lot of commonalities, and that's where it's interesting to see what was common, to see what is what lessons should have been learned, but clearly didn't stick, and that's a good place to start. So one of them is schedule pressure. So in all three cases, we had a tremendous amount of schedule pressure, and in the case of Apollo 1, it was obvious we were in a race with the Russians. We had to beat those commies to the moon. Make sure we had truth, justice, and the American way on the lunar surface. But that was real pressure. That was real schedule pressure at the time. And it was neck and neck in that it was a space race. So there was that schedule pressure. For Challenger, it was more budgetary driven. So for the space shuttle, it was initially promised to be a space truck, that this was going to be a reliable system that was going to be launching regularly. And NASA was trying to get to a flight rate of 24 per year. Because if you take their budget and divide it by even 9, which the year before Challenger, they achieved the peak flight rate of 9 per year. If you divide their budget by 9, that's still a very, very big number. It looks a lot better to Congress if you can divide it by 24. So they're pushing really, really hard to get to a flight rate of 24. 9 was the highest they ever achieved. In fact, if you look over the course of the program, the average number of flights per year was 4.5.
Wow.
So trying to get to 24 was not a very realistic goal, and there was tremendous schedule pressure. Finally, Columbia, in a very similar way, it was budgetary driven because they were way behind schedule. They were trying to build the space station. We were way over budget, and we promised Congress that we would complete the core of the space station by 2004, which was a very ambitious, very aspirational promise to be making. So in all three cases, people were rushing. And when you rush, you make mistakes. Lessons that you can take away from that is that, hey, just be aware of this. When you are part of an organization, a company that where the leadership is putting a lot of pressure on the rank and file to stick to schedule or do things quickly.
Or to budget, or
applying a lot of either schedule or budget pressure. And a lot of times those are one and the same. But either way, that should be a red flag as a compliance officer. You should say, I really need to be careful here. Because when people are under that kind of pressure, that's when they cut corners. And that's where they make mistakes.
And there's all the data that shows that people under stress make horrible decisions. It's when the superstitious mind takes over the rational mind.
Absolutely.
So that was one of the factors. Mm-hmm. You said there were a few. What were the others?
Another one is a really interesting phenomenon called normalization of deviance. I can define this as saying, this is when something bad is happening, or something incorrect, or even unlawful is happening, but there's an absence of negative consequences. So basically, you're doing something wrong, but you're getting away with it over and over again. In the beginning, you know what you're doing is wrong. You know that this is not the way it's supposed to be, and you're worried about it. But after you get away with it so many times, you eventually forget that what you're doing is actually very dangerous or very wrong or improper. And you normalize that deviance or that thing that's happening that's wrong. You just, after a while, it becomes normal. And a great example, there's examples in all three. I'll just focus on Columbia. The example there is the foam falling off the tank, which ultimately was the cause of the loss of Columbia. A giant piece of foam came off the external tank, the big orange tank on the space shuttle, and it slammed into the wing and blew a hole in the front of the wing, and that's eventually what led to the death of the astronauts on board. Well, foam had been coming off the tank from the very first flight of the space shuttle. From STS-1, the very first mission with Young and Crippen, foam was coming off. And at the time, it was treated as a big deal. It was a big deal. It should be treated as a big deal. The design requirements for the amount of allowable foam to be falling off the tank was zero. There wasn't supposed to be anything coming off. But right away, there was coming off. And in the beginning, they worked really hard to try to mitigate that. But it was a very intractable technical problem. It was very hard to keep that foam. It's a rocket. It's got a lot of vibration. The environments are really extreme. It's hard to keep that foam from falling off. So they kept trying, and they kept treating it seriously for a long time. But in its meantime, they were flying space shuttles, and nothing bad was happening. And after a while, this thing that initially was classified as a major anomaly, something that needed to be fixed, became just a kind of a routine occurrence. And it eventually wasn't even brought up anymore at the briefings that they would have before each of the flights, the flight readiness reviews. It just became normal, and nobody thought it was really going to be a problem until it was, and we lost Columbia. So that's a great example, but there are examples from the other tragedies as well.
And I think, you know, what was interesting, as you pointed out previously in our conversations, is that when, in fact, the Challenger tragedy occurred, they were so used to it that they didn't think it was possible. It took an actual demonstration to show that.
Right. That normalization of deviance, the belief that this was now normal, was so strong that the leadership of the space shuttle program was in deep denial even after the accident occurred, and even after they had photographic evidence that foam had hit the wing. They still refused to believe it could have been that they thought it had to be something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a good caution for companies that have been getting away with things for years never to believe that you can keep doing that. It's striking to me as you tell these stories, you know, even though we're talking about rockets and outer space, how practical, down to earth, and for business all of this is. You know, you spent several years in the private sector now. How do you think compliance teams can incorporate this learning?
Well, I think, you know, whenever you're dealing with any kind of risk, these kind of concepts of, you know, being aware of schedule pressure, watching out for normalization of deviance can apply to any risk management endeavor, right? And compliance, you know, example would be if you're getting, maybe, you know, you're following improper business practices or improper accounting practices, and it's been going on for years, and you know, they've just been getting away with it, and so nobody's paying attention, nobody even bats an eye anymore. Well, it's the same as the foam falling off the tank, right? It could bite you in a big way eventually. So it's something that I think that when you think of it in those terms, you realize the importance of it. And other things, too, when you look at these incidents that could be applied to compliance, are just simple things like encouraging dissent, making sure that people with dissenting opinions are free to speak up. So you should have good whistleblower policies and protect the people who are raising their hand and saying, hey, you know what, I think something here is not right. That's something that didn't happen adequately for Columbia.
Yeah, I think, as you said, there were people who were warning for a long time that the O-rings wouldn't be able to handle a cold weather launch, but nobody really wanted to listen.
Right. Or that leadership was telegraphing the answer that they wanted to hear, right? They were saying, hey, one manager castigated the engineers at Thiokol that were talking about the O-rings for Challenger, and saying that it was too cold to fly and it was dangerous. They said, by God, when do you want me to fly? You know, July? So they were telegraphing very clearly the answer that they wanted to hear. Same thing with Columbia. And so as a leader, in management, if you want an unbiased, if you want good information for you to make a decision on, it's really important that you don't tell your team what the right answer is before they even think about it. And that's something that they failed to do for both Challenger and Columbia.
Well, it's great advice. It's great insight. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us again.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA saying I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspective.